Okay, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 231, and it is May 4th. We're going to spend just a couple minutes finishing up lymphatic system and move on to respiratory system today. And we're in pretty good shape, which means we have 4 lectures left. One on digestive, one on urinary, and 2 on diversification systems in the body. All right, so let's see, lymphatic system. We talked about some functions last time, and we said that there is special tissue that filters lymph as it travels back to the subclavian vein. And those special little centers are called lymph nodes. You have a number of different places in your body where there's an aggregation of these lymph nodes that are superficial, so when they become activated, they swell up, and they can be palpated very easily, like in the cervical region, in the axillary region, and inguinal region. And so sometimes maybe a clinician might actually palpate those lymph nodes to kind of map out the extent of an infection that you're having. All right, so here is an example of a lymph node, slide on the right. And I'm going to turn a couple of these lights off right here. That's good so you can see them. Can you see the slides okay? Just good enough? Is it so bad that I should just turn the projectors off, or should I leave them on? You don't care. Okay, I'm going to leave them on. Okay, so here is a lymph node. Of course, we're zoomed way in, so it looks huge right here, but they're actually fairly small. They're smaller than a fingernail on your little finger. And you can see that here are some lymphatic vessels that bring lymph to this node. And then I see 2 lymphatic vessels that are taking lymph away from the node. And in between, this node is filtering the lymph and looking for pathogens and things that shouldn't be in your body. All right? And so these right here are what we call afferent lymphatic vessels because they're bringing lymph to, and these over here are efferent lymphatic vessels because they're taking lymph away. And all of these lymphatic vessels are very low pressure, and so what kind of blood vessel should you think about as a model to how lymph flows through these lymphatic vessels? Should you think of a capillary or an artery or a vein? These vessels right here, what do they remind you of? Artery or a capillary or a vein? A vein, to me, they remind me of a vein because they're very low pressure, the walls are very thin, but there's another structure that I see that you find in veins, and those are these little valves right here. That's right. So these lymphatic vessels really act very much like veins. Okay, and on the outside of a lymph node, you have a capsule, and then you have invagination of the capsule forming these septations that we call trabeculae. It forms different compartments within the lymph node right here, and we have some areas like the medullary cord right here that is cellular, and then you have the sinus, which is filled with lymph. Okay, and lymph just passes by all of these cells, and if there are bacteria or viruses, these cells, okay, can phagocytize them, and it can activate the immune system. And then there are lymph cells like lymphocytes then that learn how to identify that pathogen and then produce antibodies against that particular pathogen. And the antibodies then can attach to a virus or a bacteria and deactivate it, prevent it from becoming infectious. And that happens in what we call these germinal centers right here. Germinal centers are these little circular structures that we call a follicle. But functionally, we call it a germinal center because when the immune system becomes activated by a pathogen, it starts to grow. These cells start to grow and multiply, and so that's why we call it a germinal center. Because what does germination really mean? It means to grow, right? Like if you have a seed and then you put it in some moist soil and it starts to grow, we call that germination. So this lymph node will actually get bigger when it starts to fight an infection. And that's why they can be palpated when somebody has an infection, right? And because it starts to swell up because of proliferation of all these different cells right here, they can actually become a little sore as well, the lymph nodes. All right, so that is a lymph node. And remember, lymph has to pass through at least one node on the way back to the subclavian vein. But in some cases, it's many, many more. So the job of a lymph node is to filter lymph. That takes us to the next organ, okay, which is a spleen. And the job of a spleen is kind of similar. Let me move this over here. The job of the spleen is kind of similar. It's made for filtering, right, fluid, but in this particular case, it doesn't filter lymph. It filters blood, which could be very similar to lymph, except lymph doesn't have red blood cells in it. But there could be pathogens in blood. So the job of the spleen is to, again, filter blood, look for pathogens, and it can activate the immune system when it finds pathogens. The lymphocytes then can recognize a pathogen that's in the blood and develop an antibody to kill that particular antigen. Another job of the spleen is that since it's filtering blood, it can also get rid of old and damaged red blood cells. And you know that's a big job. Because how many red blood cells die in your body every second? I think I told you. Did I ever tell you that? Okay, between 2 and 3 million. That's right. 2 and 3 million red blood cells die in your body every second. And the spleen maybe starts to recycle some of those materials that are inside those red blood cells so they can be used again, like hemoglobin and iron molecules and things like that. All right, so the spleen is located in the upper left abdominal cavity, kind of posterior to the stomach. It filters blood of old red blood cells in red pulp, right? And it filters blood of pathogens and activates the immune system in white pulp. Maybe I have that on the next slide over here. Okay. So here is red pulp, right? This is for recycling red blood cells, and these are the germinal centers right here for fighting infection. Okay. And another function of the spleen is that it is also a reservoir of red blood cells in red pulp right here. So that if somebody experiences a significant hemorrhage, the spleen can then donate those red blood cells to your cardiovascular system so that you don't become anemic to some extent. All right, the other thing that is kind of clinically interesting is that the matrix that the spleen is built within is reticular tissue. It's a connective tissue. We've talked about that quite a bit. And in terms of strength, what's the strength of reticular connective tissue? Is it really strong or is it relatively weak? Okay, because it doesn't have collagen, right? The spleen is weak because it only has those very thin and highly branched reticular fibers. So the spleen is easily damaged when it's traumatized. And look how vascular it is. All right? And so when the spleen is damaged, it has a tendency to bleed. And since it only has reticular connective tissue, it can't hold a suture, so it can't be sutured back together. As soon as you place a suture, guess what's going to happen? You're going to have more bleeding. Right? And then you place a suture in to control that bleeding. What's going to happen? More bleeding. All right. So really the only way that you can handle a damaged and traumatized spleen is to tie off a blood vessel that's going to it and then ablate that part of the spleen that's damaged. All right. And nowadays we try to preserve as much spleen as possible, but somebody actually might have their whole spleen removed if they're in a car accident or motorcycle accident, and then you lose that particular function in your body. All right. So these germinal centers are lost. And then students usually have a question, well, gee whiz, are you immunocompromised? Do you lose part of your immune function when you lose your spleen? Well, for most people, it's not a significant issue because you have lymphatic tissue all over your body, all of that mucosa-associated lymphatic tissue, which is in all mucosal epithelium in your body and in your intestines, right, all over the place, your tonsils, right? The appendix is filled with lymphatic tissue, so in most cases, it's not a significant issue. You can lead a really normal life, right? But for instance, if you were in that motorcycle accident, right, and the spleen had to be removed, and then they also have to put some screws in your body to screw your body back together, like in bones, okay? That's a prosthesis, and one of the side effects of getting a metal implant in your body is always a high risk of infection. All right, so under those circumstances, if you don't have a spleen, guess what? You and your surgeon will have a talk about whether or not you really want to have that prosthesis put into your body, okay? Usually you don't have much of a choice, but you have to be really careful about infection from that point on. Okay, the thymus gland located in the mediastinum, that's an important place where a certain kind of lymphocyte goes to mature, and we call it a T lymphocyte because it matures where? In the thymus gland. And the T lymphocyte doesn't produce antibodies like other kind of lymphocytes do to fight infection, but the T lymphocytes help activate the immune system, but they directly learn how to identify an antigen or a bacteria. So if it bumps into a bacteria that it knows is not belonging to your body, it will attach to it and then lyse the membrane of the bacteria and explode that bacterium. So what happens to that bacterium after it explodes? Yeah, it lyses and then it can no longer be infectious. So T lymphocytes are contact killers when they bump into antigens that they recognize. The other kind of lymphocyte is a B lymphocyte that we find in germinal centers like in the spleen and lymph nodes. And those are the kind of lymphocytes that produce antibodies that just float around in your blood all over the place. All right, and when they bump into, so they're not a cell, they're just a chemical, right? When they bump into a bacteria, they bind to the membrane of the bacteria and cause the bacteria to lyse as well, killing the bacterium. So your body has a number of ways to protect itself. One is with contact killers or T lymphocytes or antibody producers or B lymphocytes that make antibodies that float around in your circulatory system. All right, so that's the immune system. But don't forget about the major functions of the lymphatic system, which is what? Maintains fluid balance, right? It's returning extracellular fluid back to the subclavian vein so that if you have to remove lymphatic vessels, then that part of your body will swell up. That's an important function. When we get to digestive system, we'll look at a lacteal. That's an important lymphatic vessel in the intestines, which absorb fats in particular. So without lymphatic vessels in your intestines, you won't be able to absorb any fats or vitamins, for instance, that dissolve in fat. And there are some vitamins that dissolve in fat and not water. And then the last thing down here is what? Self-defense system. Okay, so those are the important functions of the lymphatic system. All right, so we're done with that. So think of the lymphatic system as being like a little circulatory system, but it's one way. It only brings fluid back to the heart. There are no lymphatic vessels that take fluid away from the heart, like an artery typically does. Okay, so I'll put that away, put this away. And now we are going to move on to respiratory system, which is what we're talking about in lab this week, so I think you have pretty good understanding of some things of the respiratory system. All right, so let's see, what things do I have right here? Oh yeah, we didn't talk about the functions. You got to know a little bit more in lecture than you do in lab, of course. Okay, so what are the functions of the respiratory system? Well, it's for moving air in and out of the lungs. And why do we move air in and out of the lungs? Why do we move air into the lungs? Because there are molecules in air that our mitochondria need. For instance, that would be oxygen. Okay? So in order for mitochondria to make ATP, mitochondria need oxygen. And without oxygen, those mitochondria can't make ATP. And if you can't deliver oxygen to mitochondria in your brain, when does your brain start to run out of ATP and you lose consciousness? In about 3 seconds. Right? So that's how critical that function is. And then if that blood flow isn't restored, then the brain is going to die. It's going to run out of so much ATP, it can never come back to life, right? Which is what? Death. When does that happen? After 3 minutes, right? So people don't have a lot of time to restore circulation to the brain. That is critical. Okay, so ventilation is just moving air in and out of the lungs. An important function of the lungs is gas exchange between the air that's in the lungs and blood that is in the lungs. So what part of the lungs is this exchange taking place in? In terms of the cardiovascular system, you're going to immediately think of what? A capillary, because it's thin. All right, so there's going to be a corresponding place where we find air, and it's going to be thin as well. And we're going to call that an alveolus. It's going to be a little spherical structure inside the lung that holds air, and right on the surface is loaded with capillaries. All right, another function of the respiratory system is to transport oxygen and CO2 so that it can move from one part of the body to the other. And fortunately, we have a nice fluid connective tissue blood that can flow from one region to the other to distribute this CO2 and oxygen. All right, and then, of course, we can't forget about the capillaries that are in the systemic parts of your body, right? The systemic circulation, and that allows for exchange once again of oxygen and CO2. All right, so now we can move on to some anatomy. So here is a slide that I was showing you in lab. The upper respiratory tract includes the nostrils right here. Sometimes we call these nares. Here's an external nare. This is the entrance of air into the nasal cavity. And this first part right over here is really called the vestibule, nasal vestibule. All right, and posterior to the nasal cavity is the nasopharynx. And when I say pharynx, what's the common English word for pharynx? Like if you have an infection, you would say, I have a sore throat, right? So pharynx is really your throat. So here's the nasopharynx, here's the oropharynx, and then posterior to the larynx right here, here is the laryngopharynx. Okay, so the pharynx is a common passageway for both air that we're breathing and food that we're eating, right? And so everything above the larynx is what we call the upper respiratory tract, because you can actually breathe through your mouth, of course. And starting at the larynx, proceeding inferiorly, this is what we call the lower respiratory tract. All right, so you got the nose, nasopharynx, oropharynx, laryngopharynx, nasal cavity with the nasal conchae in there. All right, that's the upper respiratory tract. And then you bump into the larynx right here that has cartilage, which forms the structure. All right, and so that's the beginning of the lower respiratory tract when we start to see this cartilage. The first thing we see is this epiglottis right here. This is a trapdoor. Okay, so when you swallow something, you want food not to go into the trachea and then end up in the lungs. That won't do you any good. As a matter of fact, that might be very harmful if you do that. You want food to slide over the larynx and then go down into the esophagus. And then where's that food going to go once it's in the esophagus? If everything's working right, it's going to slide right into the stomach, right? So you don't want food in airways. You want it to go into the esophagus. And that trapdoor right there made out of cartilage is the epiglottis. Right? And we can see it aids in swallowing, but it also maintains, it keeps this airway open. All right, the voice box is in the larynx as well. There are vocal cords that when air passes over them, they vibrate. And that vibration then is what? It's a sound. It produces sound, right? So when you have an inflammation of the throat, we call that a pharyngitis, and you know it just feels rough and scratchy, right? When you have an inflammation of the larynx, how is that manifest? You lose your voice because that's where the vocal cords are located, right? So they'll be so inflamed, maybe they don't like to vibrate and produce sounds, okay? So let's look at some, I don't really go into nasal cartilages, but I suppose that could be important for somebody that's having trouble breathing, okay, to know a lot about those nasal cartilages if you ever hurt your nose really, really bad. All right, so here's a nice diagram of the three divisions of the pharynx. Here you see that nice epiglottis, the trapdoor that flops over the opening to the larynx. That opening to the larynx is what we call the glottis. So some people include some structures on the walls of the larynx as being part of the glottis, but maybe you should just think of it as being the opening into the larynx, just like the pupil is what? An opening in the iris that allows light into the eye, right? Okay. All right, and then I see some other cartilages of the larynx right here. All right, the other cartilages that we have, so we have a zoomed-in region. Here's a nice hyoid bone that we looked at, and we can see the epiglottis kind of peeking up behind it. This anterior part of the larynx, right, and guys, you can see this very easily because they have a very large laryngeal prominence right here. This is the thyroid cartilage because associated with this cartilage is the thyroid gland in about this location right here, bilaterally on either side and anterior to the larynx right here. So that's a nice thyroid cartilage. It's kind of shaped like a C, which means that it doesn't completely encircle the larynx. It's only mostly on the lateral margins and the anterior side. And on the back, it will just be ligaments. So that's the first cartilage you got to know something about. Then here is another cartilage of the larynx, inferior to the thyroid cartilage. That's the cricoid cartilage. And the cricoid cartilage does completely circle the larynx. You can find it posteriorly and anteriorly as a ring, though it does change position in the cranial caudal direction as we look from the side over here, right? So we can see the thyroid cartilage right here. And then here is the cricoid cartilage on that anterior view. It looked really small, but as it rings around to the back, look how big it gets. So the cricoid cartilage is a very prominent cartilage that you should be able to see, and it forms a complete ring. The last cartilage that I think you have to know about, well, I got two in lecture. Here is a third one. This is the arytenoid, and this one can pivot on the cricoid cartilage. One little process of the arytenoid cartilage is attached to a true vocal cord, and it can apply tension to the vocal cord. And when it applies tension to the vocal cord, what happens to the sound of your voice? It gets higher in pitch, right? When tension is applied to it. And when the tension is released, what happens to the sound of your voice? It gets lower in pitch, right? So that's a way to change the pitch of your voice by articulating this arytenoid cartilage because it attaches to the vocal cords right here. And there's the muscle that applies that tension, and that is the arytenoid muscle. I don't think I have that on your sheet to know, but you could probably have guessed what the name of that muscle is. The last little cartilage right here is the corniculate cartilage. You can see it in lab. And it's just right on one of the superior horns of this arytenoid cartilage. All right, so that's the larynx. Then we get down into the trachea. Okay, and the trachea has cartilages as well. They don't completely girdle the windpipe or the trachea. They're shaped like a C, so the posterior part has a ligament and also has a muscle, and I can see a muscle right here. So, for instance, if this muscle right here is called the arytenoid muscle because it attaches to the arytenoid cartilage. Guess what the name of this muscle is right here that attaches to the trachea? You could just probably guess that's the trachealis muscle, right? Okay, and the tracheal cartilages can't completely encircle the trachea because on this posterior part, you find the esophagus right here. And when you swallow something, there's a big bolus of food that actually projects a little bit into the trachea as it moves down. And if it couldn't make its way a little bit into the trachea as it's moving down the esophagus right here, then you couldn't swallow anything, right? So you can't have any cartilage on this posterior part of the trachea because it has to allow that bolus of food to move down into the stomach. Okay, so one thing you might notice is that it looks like these windpipes right here are open all the time. And they are, because that cartilage is holding open the larynx all the time and the trachea right here, because there are significant pressure changes in the thoracic cavity to move air in and out of your lungs. So air will move from a place of high pressure to low pressure. So in order to get air out of your lungs, you have to compress or decrease the volume of your thoracic cavity, compress your thorax, and then that pressurizes the air in your lungs so that it goes out into the atmosphere. But if you're compressing your thoracic cavity, you're also compressing what? The trachea right here. And when you do that, the trachea would collapse, right? And air can't leave your lungs if you have a collapsed trachea, right? So that's why these airways have cartilage. They're held open all the time so that you can pressurize your chest and these tubes won't collapse, so the air can still move in and out of your lungs. And you should also appreciate that if this trachea collapses and you can't move air out, what happens to your next inspiration? Can you breathe air in? You can't breathe air in if you can't get rid of the air that's already in your lungs, right? So expiration is just as important as inspiration. And indeed, some people that have emphysema, they have a really difficult time exhaling, which means what? They have difficulty inhaling. But their primary problem is exhalation, not inhalation. Okay, then let's look at the bronchial tree. All right, the bronchial tree. Oh, here is just a really nice slide of the trachea, right, the nice hyaline cartilage, C-shaped ring. Here's the lumen of the trachea, that just posterior to it is the esophagus. There's that nice trachealis muscle. And don't forget the lining of the trachea. What kind of membrane is that? Is it a serous membrane or a mucous membrane? It's a mucous membrane because it's lining a cavity that's open to the outside world, and it has a special epithelium on it, which is, anybody remember what kind of epithelium I see? Here's a little clue right here. What does that little margin look like? It looks like it has little projections coming off the cells, and those indeed are cilia, right? And these cilia are sweeping all the time. It also, these cells, there are goblet cells that secrete mucus, and so the trachea traps a lot of dust particles so that these dust particles don't go down into the lungs and plug your lungs up, and then the cilia sweep the dust particles out of the trachea. And which way are they sweeping? Down, or are they sweeping up? They're sweeping up, right? So it's sweeping all that debris up out of your lungs, up into your pharynx, all right? And then when it's in your pharynx, what do you do? Oh, no, you just swallow it down. You get it out of your body that way. Unless what? Unless you're a baseball player, then you have plenty of opportunity to spit it out. But usually we don't do that, right? Okay, so don't forget about that pseudostratified ciliated columnar epithelium. It's pretty nifty, and I'm sure you know you had a lot of fun looking at it underneath the microscope. Okay. Okay, so we were looking at the bronchial tree. Let's find that bronchial tree right here. Okay, so here is the trachea going through the mediastinum, the superior part of the mediastinum. When it gets to about the level of the heart, all right, it bifurcates because you have some lobes on the right side, some lobes on the left. And which lung looks bigger, the right lung or the left lung? The right one looks bigger, and as a matter of fact, you can see that it has three lobes, a superior, a middle, and inferior, right? Because over on the left, there's something that's taking up some space, and of course, you know what that is. That is the heart. So here we have a little cardiac notch. You have that in your lab list to make sure that you can identify that. So the left lung only has a superior and inferior lobe. Okay, so this first bifurcation from the trachea, we call this a main bronchus. It has cartilage. All bronchi are held open all the time. And then there is another bifurcation. Then these are what we call secondary bronchi. And then there's going to be another bifurcation. This would be a tertiary bronchi. So these just go to smaller and smaller parts of the lung. All right, and because the left lung is a lot bigger than the right lung, the right lung is a lot bigger than the left, this right main bronchus is quite a bit bigger than the left main bronchus. So when debris falls into the trachea, it has a much greater tendency to fall into this right main bronchus because it's bigger. And notice it's more of a direct straight shot into that bronchus over here compared to making more of an angled 90-degree turn right into the smaller left main bronchus right here. Okay, so you might run into that some point in time. Okay, so there you got the lobes of the lung. Okay, and then finally, these bronchi are going to bifurcate into very small microscopic airways that we call bronchioles. Okay, so now you would need a microscope to see these things. These bronchioles right here have smooth muscle around them, which means that they can constrict and they can dilate. And there's something missing from them. They're also missing cartilage. Right, so if they had cartilage, then they couldn't constrict and dilate by these smooth muscles right here. All right, so this is what we call a bronchiole. When you get to a bronchiole, you no longer have cartilage. So that's the designation to it. All right, and then so here is a nice terminal bronchiole that leads us to a structure that has all these little sacs. And these are what we call alveoli. We're going to look at these in just a second. Some of these respiratory bronchioles do contain alveoli on them, not many, but a few. So actually exchange can take place even in these respiratory bronchioles because they have alveoli. But most of the exchange takes place in these alveolar sacs that are what? Just loaded with alveoli. Okay, so the big difference between a bronchiole and a bronchus is that a bronchiole doesn't have cartilage, and some bronchioles can even allow for exchange. Okay. All right, so let's look at the functional and structural unit of air exchange in the lungs. Oh, here's a pretty good example right here. All right, so here is just a micrograph of what the lungs look like. It kind of looks like a sponge. It's made up of all these little sacs right here. And one of these sacs is called an alveolus. They can inflate, and air can pass from one alveolus to another via these alveolar pores. So they have a tendency to all inflate in unison. And then you can see some structures that are lining the surface of the alveoli. You could probably guess what some of those structures are. Okay. And here, you can see the terminal bronchiole, respiratory bronchiole leading to this alveolar sac. And here you can see a pulmonary artery with blue blood bringing it to an alveolus. And these are capillaries. So what's the function of this capillary right here? Exchange. So CO2 will leave right from the arterial side, and then oxygen will enter the capillary, and then it's brought back to the heart via this. What would we call this thing right here, this red blood vessel? You would say pulmonary because it's in the lungs, but pulmonary what? Is it a vein or an artery? Don't forget, it's red colored. It's a vein. That's right, I was trying to trick you because it's so easy to make that mistake, right? So you really have to think. If it's a pulmonary circulation, arteries are blue. Remember, an artery is taking blood away from the heart. A vein is bringing blood back to the heart. But since this is a pulmonary vein, it's coming back oxygenated, therefore it looks red. Yeah, so try not ever to forget that one. Take your time if you're answering that question on a test anytime. It's easy to get it mixed up and think of it as the systemic circulation. Okay, so you have capillaries around alveoli, but you'll also have some other structures right here. And I wish I could tell you what color they are, but they kind of look green, maybe, or yellow, these little filaments right here. These are elastic fibers. All right, so what can you tell me about elastic? It's made to stretch, all right, without being damaged, which is a nice thing. But what's even a better thing about elastic? What happens to it when you let go after you're done stretching it? It goes back to its original shape, okay? So inhalation, we use a muscle to get air into the lungs. That's the diaphragm. And all these alveoli expand. They get big. They hold a lot of air. And then we relax the diaphragm. And guess what happens to the shape of these alveoli? Okay, they go back to their original shape because of all these elastic fibers around them. When you're breathing quietly like you are right now, you don't need a muscle to exhale. There's enough elasticity in the normal lung to exhale most of the air all by itself. So inhalation is active. You need the diaphragm, right, when you're breathing quietly like we are right now. But expiration is not active. It's what we call passive, right, when you're breathing quietly because of why? All of these elastic fibers right here. So next week I'm going to bring in a little quiz to take. I'm going to bring in a model of an alveolus, and you'll have to tell me which one is a good model and why. So think of this elastic property of an alveolus, but it won't be for course points. It will just be for fun. Okay, so don't forget about these elastic fibers. So some people have a disease where these elastic fibers degenerate or they're attacked, and guess what they have trouble doing? They have trouble breathing. Why? Because they can't exhale. Right? And if they can't exhale, then there's no room for air to go when you're trying to inhale. So that's kind of a miserable condition right there to have. Huh? That's not quite emphysema. Not quite. It doesn't directly attack the elastic tissues. Okay. So here is a zoomed in region of one alveolus. And think back to your tissues. and an epithelium. What kind of epithelium is thin? And what's the function of a thin epithelium? Okay, like a simple squamous epithelium is really, really thin. And if it's a simple squamous epithelium, what is that specialized to do? Exchange across the membrane. So things can move from one side or the other because it's a very thin membrane. And look at all these cells right here. Look how thin they are. All of these alveoli are made up of a simple squamous epithelium, and so that's specialized for exchange. So that when there is oxygen in the alveolus, it can move across that simple squamous epithelium into a capillary, and the wall of a capillary is also what kind of epithelium? A simple squamous epithelium, so it can diffuse into the blood very easily. Okay, so that's the purpose of this alveolus. Okay, now let's zoom in to the wall of this alveolus. There is something called the respiratory membrane. Here is the respiratory membrane. So here is the alveolus that contains air. So you have the wall of the alveolus. You have a little interstitial space, maybe some connective tissue, which connects the capillary to the alveolus, and then you have the wall of the capillary. So these things right here make up the respiratory membrane. Wall of the alveolus, this connective tissue, interstitial space, and then the wall of the capillary right here. That's the respiratory membrane. Okay. Well, we have some other cells in the lung besides the simple squamous epithelium that makes the alveolus. We have some of these right here that are macrophages. These are shapeshifters. They can crawl around inside this alveolus and crawl into the next one. They started out in the blood and crawled the way out of this capillary right here. They were once a monocyte. And the job of this macrophage or a monocyte is to phagocytize particles that don't belong in your body and then destroy them. So that if you do inhale bacteria, like probably we do with every breath that we take, then these macrophages bump into those bacteria and kill them before they can cause an infection under most circumstances, right? So that's the job of this macrophage right here, is to fight infection or to fight bacteria, viruses, or fungi that get into the lungs, right, like they do with every breath that you take. There's another kind of cell, this one right here. This is what we call a type 2 alveolar cell. The kind of cell that makes up the wall of the alveolus is a type 1 alveolar cell. But this type 2 over here is special because it secretes a compound on the inside wall of the alveolus, and it kind of acts like a little soap or a detergent. And did you ever have any soap on your fingertips and rub your fingertips together? What does it feel like? Really, really slippery. So that's the job of that material, because water by itself is kind of sticky. I don't know if any of you maybe were washing dishes and you had a couple plates or saucers, okay, on top of each other, and they fit really nice up against each other. They have the right shape. And if there's water between them, you can actually pull up the top saucer, and what does the bottom one do? It sticks to it, okay, because water has a property that we call surface tension. So it can actually glue things together. That's just one of the properties of water. So water really is sticky. And so if water, and water is on the inside of these alveoli right here, this wall would stick to this wall over here, and then air can't flow into the lungs. So this alveolar type 2 cell secretes that little soapy material, which makes the walls very slippery so they can inflate. That substance is called surfactant. And that allows the alveoli to inflate. And surfactant during gestation is produced very late. And these type 2 cells really don't get stimulated into producing surfactant until the fetus is experiencing stress at the end of term. So a baby that doesn't experience stress and is born prematurely, like maybe via a cesarean section, right, is a lot easier on the fetus than a natural vaginal delivery. Their lungs aren't going to function properly because these type 2 cells aren't secreting surfactant. Right? And sometimes what do we have to do with a newborn baby that's really premature, delivered by cesarean section? Have to put them in an incubator because their lungs really aren't functioning, they're not inflating properly because these cells here aren't mature, and they're put in an atmosphere that's relatively high in oxygen, which helps what? oxygen diffused into their body so that they can continue to develop normally. So surfactant is an important thing that you need in your lungs for what? The inflation of alveoli. Okay, so don't forget about the two kinds of cells, the type 1 and the type 2. And the type 2 is for producing surfactant so that the lungs can inflate. Okay. So surfactants prevents the walls of the alveoli from sticking together. That's really, really important. Let's see if, let's look at this slide right here. Okay, I'm going to really zoom into this region. So here we have the lungs. Inside, what cavity are the lungs in? Well, you could say the ventral body cavity, but that's not really good enough. You could say thoracic cavity, but that's not really good enough. You could say myocardial cavity, but for sure that's wrong because that's where the heart is. Or the mediastinum, that's wrong because that's right in the middle. So you want to say what? Pleural cavity, right? That's the most specific cavity. Pleural cavity is just part of the thoracic cavity, which is part of the ventral cavity. So here you have the pleural cavity, which is on the outside of the lung. Now, is that pleural cavity open to the outside world or not? The inside of the lung is. Otherwise, air wouldn't be able to move in and out. But the outside of the lung is not open to the outside world. So what kind of membrane lines the surface of the lungs? A serous membrane, right? Because a mucous membrane lines a cavity that's open to the outside world. And so we call that the pleural membrane, right? Because it's on the lung. So let's zoom into this region right here. Oh, here you can see that nice little cardiac notch in the left lung. So here is the pleural serous membrane. The division of the serous membrane that's right on the surface of the lungs is what we call the visceral pleura, right? It's right on the surface of the visceral organ, so it's the visceral pleura membrane. And then lining the thoracic wall right here, and you can see there's muscles right here, and that's called the parietal division of the pleural serous membrane. Right? But you all know that how many parts are there to a serous membrane? Are there two? Are we done thinking about a serous membrane? Or are there four, or how many are there? There are three parts to a serous membrane. You've got the visceral division on the visceral organ. You have the parietal membrane on the body cavity wall. And then you have a space in between them. Okay? And that's the serous cavity or pleural cavity filled with serous fluid. So here's that pleural cavity. And now this fluid right here does not have any surfactant in it. So guess what the visceral membrane and the parietal membrane like to do if they're in a watery environment? They like to stick together, okay? Because of the surface tension in water. So when the rib cage, okay, or thoracic cavity expands, what's it going to do? It's going to pull on the surface of the lungs to try to expand the lungs so that air will flow in. So it's very important to have that nice watery fluid in this pleural cavity, but the slippery fluid in the alveolar spaces, right? So that the alveoli will inflate. Okay. So that's the mechanism of inhalation and exhalation. It's by changing the size of the thoracic cavity. So let's see if I can explain this a little bit. Right here, we see something that has maybe a diaphragm on it. Nah, we don't have a good... Here's a pretty good diagram to start with, all right? When the diaphragm is relaxed, it makes a dome right here, kind of a dome-shaped structure, which is poking up into the pleural cavities, right? And when you inhale, I was right on this figure. When you inhale, the diaphragm contracts. And when it contracts, it becomes flat. It just goes across from one side of the rib cage to the other. So the volume of the thorax increases by this amount right here. And when the volume increases, that sucks air into the lungs and helps expand the lungs when the diaphragm contracts. Okay? And then remember, one property of skeletal muscle, again, is elasticity, right? Muscle is extensible and it can contract, but it is also elastic. So when the diaphragm contracts, right, it's flat, but when it relaxes, what does it go and do? It goes back up to this dome-shaped structure, which then helps force air out of the lungs. So the diaphragm is important for inspiration when it contracts, and then passively it helps expiration when it relaxes because it goes back to this dome shape right here. All right, there are a couple other muscles that are important for inspiration. Okay, besides the diaphragm is the most important one. Okay, here is the explanation of these things right here. Okay. Maybe I need to scoot that down a little bit more. Okay, so diaphragm is most important for the kind of breathing that you're doing right now, but sometimes you're exercising. And when you're exercising, is it easy to hold your breath or do you have to breathe more frequently? You have to breathe deeper and more frequently, right? So there are two kinds of breathing. There is quiet breathing when you're not exercising, and then forced breathing when you are. When you're forced breathing, you have to move a lot more air in and out of your lungs. And then you need different muscles to help you do that. All right, so for quiet breathing, you only need the diaphragm. But for forced breathing, when you're exercising, you need the pectoralis muscle, pectoralis minor. You need some external intercostals, and I see an external intercostal right here. Okay, and also you need maybe sternocleidomastoid and serratus anterior. And what these muscles do is that when you're done with expiring, your lung volume is very small. But when all these other muscles start to contract, like external intercostals and pectoralis muscle, it pulls the rib cage out and up laterally, and it pulls the sternum anteriorly and up. And so that enlarges the thoracic cavity. Just like depression, when the diaphragm contracts, that enlarges the thoracic cavity, air flows into your lungs. So these muscles right here help in forced inspiration, when you have to move a lot of air in and out of your lungs. All right, so in terms of the intercostal muscle, for inspiration, it is the external intercostal that I see right here. Okay, and why do we call this the external intercostal? Because it's the superficial one that's on the exterior wall. There's also an internal intercostal over here that's not used for inspiration. This muscle right here, the internal intercostal, pulls the rib cage down. And when your rib cage is pulled down, that forces air out of your lungs. That is necessary for forced breathing. So internal intercostals are important for hyperventilation, and also all of the abdominal muscles help for forced exhalation as well, because that will compress the abdominal contents right up into the thoracic cavity that will help expel air from the lungs. Kind of almost like doing a Heimlich maneuver on somebody, but that's for forced expiration. Okay, so what do I want you to know about these muscles? With those intercostals, let's just practice this for a second. What muscle is important for forced inspiration of the intercostals? Forced inspiration. It is the external intercostal. Okay, so you got to kind of change the prefix on those words for it to make sense. And for forced expiration, it is the internal intercostals, because they pull the rib cage down inferiorly. Okay. So those are the skeletal muscles. But remember, quiet breathing, the active part is only inspiration for quiet breathing because of the elastic properties of the diaphragm and the alveoli themselves. It is passive, right, in the normal lung. But the lung is pretty delicate tissue because it's so thin, can be damaged very easily. So take care of your lungs. Don't put a lot of junk in your lungs that don't belong there, because it can damage that elastic tissue, can damage the alveoli, and then it will damage those capillaries and you don't have good gas exchange. And actually, as we get older, we lose pulmonary function anyway, just by natural processes. Okay, so let's talk about gas exchange for a little bit. And gas exchange, let's see if I have anything right here that kind of looks like a ruler. Do you see a ruler anywhere? I don't see a ruler. I used to have a ruler in here. Okay. All right, well, I can guess at something. What is this distance from here to about here? What does that distance look like? Looks like a yard, pretty close. But since this is a science class, let's call it a meter. This is 1 meter right here. So that's our ruler. So I'm going to take this ruler right here, and I'm going to measure this doorway. Okay, so what's the width of this doorway right here? Oh, I've got the meter stick right here in my hand. Okay, what's the width of this doorway? Oh, look at that. Perfect. It's exactly 1 meter. Okay, so that's nice. That's the width. All right, now what's the height of this doorway? We see that it is 1 meter, and then, oh, exactly 2 meters. It's fortunate that the meter stick is so nice. All right, so that's a doorway right here. Let's calculate the surface area. How would we calculate the surface area for this doorway? What would we do? Multiply the width of the door, which we said was what? 1 meter, times the height. So it's the width times the height. Okay, so what is the surface area of this door right here? It's just 2 square meters, right? Okay, and so what's the purpose of this doorway? In one word, it's for exchange, right? So people are coming in and they're coming out. How do people exchange from one room to another? Through a surface area, which we commonly call a doorway, right? So when I talk about surface area in physiology or anatomy, the English word, the everyday word that you should think about is what? A surface area is really a doorway for what? Exchange, so that things can move across, okay, this separation right here, this wall. All right, so how many people can move through this doorway that's 2 square meters at one time? Two easy, maybe 3. Okay, if you get a running start, everybody at one time, you can pop through maybe 4. Okay, now let's, instead of a pedestrian doorway right here, let's make it a garage door for a car. Now what happens to exchange? Does it go up or go down? How many people can you get through a garage door at one time? Yeah, a lot more, maybe 20 or 30 people at one time. Right, running stop, pop through a lot of people at one time. So as the surface area increases, what happens to exchange? It increases, right, in a really big way, really fast way. Okay, well, the shape of all those alveoli is such that it provides for a surface area. The number of alveoli that you have in your lungs, I say right here, is about 300 million. And they're like little tiny microscopic grapes. So we could take all of those little grapes and flatten them out, right? Put all 300 million of them, flatten them out like skin a grape and put all the skins real flat next to each other and put it in a nice square like that. And then we would see what the surface area is for what? Exchange going across the alveolus for oxygen going from the air into the capillary and CO2 from the capillary into the air of the alveolus. And you know what surface area that would be if we took all 300 million alveoli and lined and laid them out all flat next to each other? It would be 70 square meters. And what the heck is 70 square meters? Well, it sounds big, but it's nice to have a picture in your mind. Maybe you know what a tennis court looks like. Okay, 70 square meters is half of a tennis court. So that is the doorway for what? Exchange in your lungs. But it's really kind of fortunate that evolution has figured out a way to take that big surface area, which is half of a tennis court, and shrink it down so that it fits in your lungs. By what? Folding it up and making those little spherical objects. I really like that because I can't imagine why I would like to be as wide as a tennis court and half as tall as a tennis court, because it'd be really hard to get around. So that's the job of all these alveoli right here, is for exchange. Okay, so whenever I say surface area, think of doorway for exchange. We're going to look at that in the next chapter too. Oh, you know what? We talked about that respiratory membrane already in class. All right, the only other thing that some people like to do is to include that layer of surfactant in with the respiratory membrane. I lost the cursor. Ah, there it is. All right, so you've got the wall of the capillary that oxygen has to diffuse across, that little interstitial space. You've got the wall of the alveolus. Okay, and don't forget, lining the alveolus is that little detergent molecule that allows an alveolus to expand, to inflate, and that is surfactant. So that's probably a good idea to include into the respiratory membrane. Okay, so how is respiration controlled? How is breathing controlled in our body? That's probably the last thing that we need to talk about. Oh, here's a kind of a nice diagram that shows, I don't think I'll talk about that one. Okay, the respiratory center. Okay, this is areas in the central nervous system, the brain, which is, what's this part of the brain right here? That's the medulla. And then what's right above the medulla here is the pons, right? So there are some nuclei in these areas right here that are real important for controlling the diaphragm and these intercostal muscles, right? So this is what we call the respiratory control center. So what do I want you to know about that? This ventral respiratory center, okay, right here, right, is like a pacemaker for breathing. All right, so this will just automatically cause the diaphragm to contract. Like if you're unconscious or sleeping, right, even though the diaphragm is skeletal muscle, which usually means that it needs voluntary initiation to contract, but because of this ventral respiratory group right here, right, this will automatically stimulate the diaphragm to contract, right, even when you're unconscious or sleeping in normal people. These other groups right here, like the pontine respiratory center and this dorsal respiratory group, right, will adjust the period of breathing, right? Just like your heart rate, your heart will beat by itself, but it needs a little tune-up by the autonomic nervous system to adjust the rate and force of contraction. All right, so it is the pons and medulla that are necessary to control your respiration. Right here, they work together. And so if someone has a stroke or if they have a lesion in this part of the brain, all right, then guess what happens? Somebody loses the ability for themselves to automatically control contraction of the diaphragm. All right, so if that's the case, then every breath a person takes has to be voluntary, has to be initiated by some kind of conscious thought. All right, and you can imagine what that's like, because when do you all lose consciousness? Every day. And think about this person that can't breathe when they lose consciousness. Like every time you take a nap or fall asleep, right? You lose consciousness, and under those circumstances, then this person is not going to breathe, and of course, then they'll die. So what has to happen? Well, then they got to wake up. Well, which is terrible if you can only sleep for 30 seconds at a time. So then you have to be on a respirator when you're sleeping. And that disease, when this respiratory center here is damaged, we call that Odin's curse. So that happens to some people. That would be kind of a terrible disease to have. Okay. Now, the outputs of the respiratory center right here, there's a nerve that goes to the diaphragm. I think we learned what this nerve is in lab. What did we call this nerve? Because we looked at the cervical plexus in particular, and that's the phrenic nerve that goes down to the diaphragm, right? And do you remember the origins of that phrenic nerve? It comes from C3, C4, and C5, right? It goes to the cervical plexus, so that if C5 is damaged, the nerve from C5, you can still breathe normally because it gets innervation from C3 and C4, right? That's the beauty of a nerve plexus. And so how do you remember C3, 4, and 5? There's a little funny saying, which is kind of fun. You would say, what? C3, 4, and 5 does what? C3, 4, and 5 keeps you alive. Because of what? That is the origin of the phrenic nerve right here to the diaphragm. Okay, so there are some inputs to the respiratory center that will regulate respiration. there are chemoreceptors. All right, so what is a chemoreceptor? What's it sensitive to, or what does it measure? Chemicals, yeah, that's its basic name, right? It's a chemical measurer, or chemoreceptor. There are chemoreceptors in the brain, okay, and in the pons and medulla right here, and they're very sensitive to changes in carbon dioxide. I think this is kind of important because this is not intuitive. It's backward than how somebody would think. If you were going to pick a molecule that would adjust your respiration, what molecule maybe would you pick that your body should monitor all the time to adjust your breathing? What's that molecule that mitochondria really need? They need, well, mitochondria make ATP, but what does a mitochondria need to make ATP is my question. Oxygen. Okay, so without studying physiology, I always thought it would be really important to monitor oxygen inside your body because that's what allows mitochondria to make ATP. But that's not really what happens inside your body. The most important molecule is CO2, which is what? A byproduct of respiration. It's the byproduct, the throwaway product when mitochondria make ATP. So when this builds up in your body, that's a powerful stimulus for increasing ventilation, for increasing respiration, increasing breathing, moving air in and out of your lungs. The other thing that happens is when CO2 increases, the pH of your body decreases. We don't talk about pH in here very much, but it's a measure of acidity in your body. So when your pH decreases, your body becomes way more acidic. All right, So what's really important stimulation for breathing is increased CO2 or when your body becomes acidic. We call that a decrease in pH. That's a powerful stimulus for ventilation. And these chemoreceptors are located, what, in the respiratory center, the medulla and the pons. Okay. Well, your body does measure oxygen or monitor oxygen, but it's not as sensitive. It's not a good stimulus for respiration unless oxygen decreases to drastic levels in your body, right? And those are picked up by peripheral receptors. These are sensitive only to extremely large changes or deprivations or decreases in oxygen. They're located in the carotid sinus and aortic arch. So point to your carotid sinus. Where's your carotid sinus at? Yeah, it's in your neck. It's right at the bifurcation of the common carotid to what, the internal and external carotid right there. There's like a little bulb in the blood vessel. And so there are pressure sensors there that can measure blood pressure as well as oxygen sensors that can measure oxygen. And when oxygen goes way, way down in your body, these chemoreceptors then will tell the respiratory center and the pons and medulla to increase the rate and depth of ventilation. But that's only after you're about ready to pass out because you're so low in oxygen. Okay? All right, so what did we say were the most important chemical factors that regulate respiration? Which molecule? CO2. And that's why sometimes, you know, if you're a kid and you're at a pool and you're challenging your friend, well, who can swim the longest underwater? What do kids automatically do before they start to swim underwater? They hyperventilate, right? And as you hyperventilate, you get rid of a lot of CO2 from your body. You just exhale it from your body. You lose that drive or that sensation to breathe so that you can swim underwater for a much longer period of time. So hyperventilation before you take a dive does work. It's not just a fairy tale, okay? But if you're swimming underwater, what molecule in your body are you using up a lot of? Oxygen, because your muscles are using ATP. What's another organ that needs a lot of oxygen to make ATP besides your muscles when you're exercising? Your brain, okay? So unfortunately, what happens to some people that hyperventilate before they dive underwater, this happens to people that really like to fish. We call these free divers, and they go down with a spear gun. They hyperventilate like crazy, right, before they take a dive, so they don't have that urgency to breathe when they're underwater, which would be what? Terrible. You don't want to breathe water into your lungs. So they hyperventilate. They don't have an urgency to breathe, but now they dive really, really deep looking for fish. You know, they spend a lot of time with their spear gun looking for fish. What is being depleted in their body when they're underwater? Because they're exercising. oxygen, and they can deplete their body of oxygen so much that they lose consciousness, but they never have that urge to breathe because CO2 hasn't built up in their body. So it just happens like that. And then what happens to them? Well, they're underwater maybe 20 or 30 feet, and they start to breathe when they become unconscious, and that's unfortunately their demise, unless they're with a buddy or something that can bring them up to the surface, right? So these things, you know, kind of have like an everyday application if you're a free diver. Okay. So what are some other things that can regulate respiration? Higher centers. Higher centers would be like the cerebral cortex right here, maybe the hypothalamus, right? Because they're all connected by neurons, right? So the respiration can be controlled voluntarily, right? You can put your mind to it and just stop contraction of the diaphragm voluntarily, and you can hold it so much that you're going to pass out. You'll run out of oxygen. You might be a little uncomfortable, but kids do that all the time to freak their parents out, right? If they're really mad at their parents, they'll hold their breath, right? It turns purple until they get their way, and then they pass out, and you're kind of laughing at that. Why, did you do that when you were a kid? Oh, it happened to you or your sister? Yeah, okay. But you don't really have to worry much about that, because what happens when they lose consciousness? And they don't have any lesions in their brain, then what? The respiratory centers take over automatically. As soon as they pass out, they start breathing again. So you don't have to freak out. But it's probably pretty cool and dramatic when it happens. There's probably a YouTube on it. I didn't check to see. Okay. The hypothalamus, all right, can stimulate respirations due to emotional content that's in your life. Like if you hear something really amazing, maybe something really startling, what are you going to do? You're going to go, you're going to gasp. All right, so a gasp reflex can be triggered by emotional content. Let's see, I got about maybe 30 seconds. I can't finish this up, but mostly. But proprioceptors. Proprioceptors are different kind of receptors in your body that, anybody remember what a proprioceptor does? It can measure stretch in muscles and angulation of joints, right? So as soon as you start to stretch a muscle or move a joint, even though you're not exercising very heavily, like right now you could move your knees, and that really wouldn't be like exercising, like running up the stairs or across the floor, but just by moving those muscles and those joints, you will have an urgency to breathe. So those proprioceptors will stimulate the respiratory center to start hyperventilation because they think you're exercising, using up a lot of oxygen. All right, so proprioceptors do that. And then the sign-in sheet is going around someplace, so we got to finish up with other kinds of receptors when we start next time. Okay, so I know, is the sign-in sheet around anywhere? It's way up there, really good. So don't forget that sign-in sheet. Yeah, we're almost done, but we're like 30 seconds over, so I know we have time, but I want to just talk about this next one probably for longer than 30 seconds.